The hymn, His Father's World, This Is My Father's World, is a great appreciation of God through His created world, and it's an often requested hymn at devotionals of the ASA. Today's talk could well be subtitled, What I Did on the Way Home from the ASA Meeting in Washington, D.C., where we, in fact, sang this hymn. And since the concluding Monday of the ASA conference last year was August 2nd, my dad's 90th birthday, I went home by way of Rochester, New York, to see him. And that's where we had the adventure that I'll describe here. Our story's in three parts, and this will show how geology, human technology, and religion all interacted to produce the hymn that we know and love. First, the geological story. Geologists tell us that some 450 million years ago, it's the Middle Silurian period, the entire area that we now know as the Great Lakes was a vast river delta, and rivers were washing down sediments from what are now the Appalachian Mountains, then much taller than we see them today. And the sediments that formed from those is what geologists call the Rochester formation of predominantly shales. A little later, that region was beneath a shallow tropical sea. There are all kinds of marine organisms and corals embedded in the sediments. And before any of those sediments had a chance to turn to stone, they became infiltrated by brines rich in magnesium that would convert the calcium carbonate of what would be limestone to something called dolomite or dolostone. I'm not sure what I press. I'm sorry. Thank you. To convert calcium carbonate to a mineral called dolomite that is half calcium, half magnesium, and is significantly harder than limestone. It's also more resistant to weathering. It won't fizz when you drip acid on it unless you first scratch it or pulverize it. Originally, the rock was called dolomite. I can remember it being quarried in western New York where I grew up, and it was called dolomite, but today mineralogists would call the rock dolostone. Well, perhaps a couple hundred million years ago, these newly formed rocks were uplifted. They were tilted in such a way that they're higher towards the northeast and lower towards the southwest, and they began to be eroded by wind and water. Since the dolostone is the hardest of the sediments, that resisted erosion, and so that began to emerge as a cliff called the Niagara Escarpment, which lines much of the present-day shores of Lake Ontario and on up into Lake Michigan. Then that area became covered by glaciers, and the ice persisted until relatively recently, something like 12,000 years ago, and then those glaciers melted and all of the torrents of water began draining through, among others, the Niagara River, going over the escarpment and scouring out the gorge that we love to visit today. So this Niagara Escarpment is a very prominent cliff that you can see all the way from Rochester, New York, and through southern Ontario, and even on up into Wisconsin. Here, just beneath Niagara Falls, you can see some of the sediments that we've been talking about. Near the base of the river is a sandstone. Halfway up the cliff is the Rochester Formation of shale, and at the very top is the Dolostone, which is called the Lockport Amabel Formation. Now, in my hometown of Rochester, we have a waterfall that's not as wide or famous, but it's just as tall as Niagara Falls. That's where the Genesee River plunges over the escarpment in downtown Rochester. Part two, the technology story. A little over a couple hundred years ago, a bankrupt flower merchant named Jesse Hawley began writing articles advocating the construction of a canal across New York State. Now, Hawley was writing from debtor's prison. He was imprisoned because his business had gone bankrupt, and he blamed that on the high cost of transportation over the poor dirt roads of the era. His ideas came to the attention of DeWitt Clinton, the governor of New York State, and so in 1817, Clinton persuaded his legislature to appropriate some $7 million for a canal. Now, in my growing up years, one could see a number of towns that had port names, like Spencer Port or Brock Port or Lock Port. And, of course, those were so named because they were along the route of the original Erie Canal. So here it goes from Rochester to Brockport, or Spencer Port, then Brockport. And as it made its way westward, it encountered its most serious obstacle, which was the Niagara Escarpment. And here boats would have to get some 70 feet higher before they could get to the level of Lake Erie at Buffalo. So about 1817, it became obvious that this area would be a major construction site for the Erie Canal. A group of speculators began buying up all of the land in the area, and most of those speculators were Quakers. And within a year or so, construction people began to arrive, and Lockport became a booming center of industry and later an important center of commerce along the Erie Canal. After Lockport, the canal turns southward and reaches the Buffalo area, a town named Tonawanda. So Lockport is an important location that's occasioned by the geology of the Niagara Escarpment. By 1824, all of the canal had been finished and was operational except the locks that were required to get up the cliff. And so in that year, you could take a canal boat all the way to Lockport, and there you'd have to get out, and they would carry you and your goods by carriage about 7 miles down the road where you could get on the other portion of the canal that was completed and finish your journey to Buffalo. Finally, as history books all tell us, in October of 1825, the locks were finally completed, and you could travel all the way from Albany to Buffalo without getting out of the boat. Now, this profile dramatizes the problem that had to be solved. You could go all the way from Rochester to the base of the escarpment without any locks, and then, according to the technology of the day, a lock could only rise 10 to 12 feet, so five of them would be required to get up the Niagara Escarpment. And the engineers decided, since a lock has a beginning and an end, the most economical way to build them would be one right after another, so that the exit from lock number one would be the entrance to lock number two. So that's what they did. This is a print from the 1830s after the locks were completed, looking downstream. This is a postcard from the beginning of the 20th century and shows us, first of all, that the boat has to make five separate lockings, each raising it about 10 feet. And in fact, there are two complete sets of locks because it might take a couple hours for a boat to go up, and that would completely block any opposing traffic. And so they have a second set of locks to descend, so the boats could be going both ways at the same time. Number of vintage postcards. Lockport was one of the wonders of the man-made world, and so people bought colored postcards to send to their friends after visits. One of the features of Lockport is said to be the world's widest bridge. It's longer than a football field. Main Street crosses it diagonally, and most of the rest of the span is just parking lot for City Hall today. In around 1915, the canal was modernized. In fact, it's called the Barge Canal today, and some of it has been rerouted, but the part from Lockport to Buffalo still follows the original route. We have bigger mechanically operated locks today, so it only requires two locks instead of five. And this postcard shows Lockport pretty much as it is today, with the modern two locks on the left, and they've left an original flight of five locks on the right, and it's a historical thing that people come from a long way around to visit. Well, after our ASA meeting, I decided that it would be fun if my dad and I visited Lockport, and so here we are in a canal boat. You can board a boat below the locks and take a tour, and they'll take you through the locks, and you hear the great big doors slamming behind you, and after the doors are closed, you hear millions of gallons of water rushing in, and that's raising the boat about 30 feet, and then the top gate opens. You go into a second lock and repeat the experience. And once you've cleared that lock, then it's smooth sailing all the way to Buffalo. The tour doesn't actually go that far. You can see some of the dolostone that has been cut in to make the channel for the canal. Well, part three is the religion. And the hymn that we know was the work of a man named Maltby Babcock. He was born in Syracuse, and through an unplanned accident, the day that we were doing this happened to be his birthday, August the 3rd. He was a graduate of Syracuse University, where he excelled as a musician. He had a powerful singing voice. He was proficient on the violin and the organ, and I've heard that he even directed an orchestra while he was there. But although he could have easily had a career as a professional musician, he felt a different calling on his life, and so he attended seminary and then was assigned the Presbyterian Church at Lockport as his first pastorate. How many minutes do we have on the clock? Okay. Thank you. So, one of the things that we wanted to visit in Lockport was Babcock's church, and here it is, the First Presbyterian Church in Lockport. It's only a block north of the canal. And curiously, the exterior of the church doesn't say very much about Maltby Babcock. They seem to be more proud of the fact that they have Tiffany stained glass windows. So this sign, which we can barely read, mentions the stained glass of Louis Tiffany. And this is an example of the beautiful stained glass windows that are inside that church. Looking down on modern-day Lockport, first of all, we can see the main street through town, which is State Route 31. Secondly, you can see the canal running diagonally from top right to lower left. Those are the original locks, which still have some water flowing through them. Below them are the modern-day locks. At the lower left is that huge bridge that we mentioned. Next to the locks is a visitor center, which you can visit. I think it's a $5 donation. And, of course, across the street from it is the First Presbyterian Church where Babcock pastored. Well, I'm going to zoom out a little farther. So the canal and the visitor center and the church are at the bottom of the picture. You can clearly see the Niagara Escarpment, a little cliff at the north edge of town. And it's about six blocks from church to the cliff. We went into this area here, which is now a city park. And these are some shots that I took in the park. Babcock loved nature, and he used to go walking in this area to escape the stresses of the pastorate. And as he was stepping out of his office to take a walk, he would always remark to his secretary, "I'm going to go out and see my father's world." So you can see where the title of the hymn comes from. A couple other views from that park. It was a hazy day. If it had been as clear as the weather we've had this week, we could have seen Lake Ontario about 10 miles out in the distance. But had the experience of walking where Maltby Babcock walked and seeing the view that inspired the hymn. Well, Babcock spent about 5 years in Lockport, and then he was called to bigger and better places. His next pastorate was the Brown Memorial Church in Baltimore, where he really distinguished himself as a pastor, showing ways of relating to all of the members of his flock, including, apparently, the first example of text messaging to some teenagers. And that church also was fond of stained glass windows, so this is a Tiffany-designed window at Baltimore that was dedicated to the memory of Babcock. In 1900, he accepted a call to the Brick Presbyterian Church in New York City. And hold on to your hats, saying that his first year's salary was $35,000. Now, that's in 1900, be three-quarters of a million today. Do you know how much your pastor makes? That unfortunately didn't last very long. New Yorkers were grateful to have Babcock at their pastor, and so they gave Babcock and his wife a tour of the Holy Land. So in February of 1901, they set off on a ship across the Atlantic, through the Mediterranean, to Egypt, where they took 2 months, mostly by mule train or horses, to travel up through Palestine to Lebanon, where they eventually concluded their adventures and got back on the boat. But by that time, Babcock was obviously ill. He made it as far as Naples, Italy, where he died in April of 1901. Moral of the story, do not give your pastor a tour of the Holy Land unless you really want to move on. Now, 1901 was the end of Babcock's ministry, and he published hardly anything during his lifetime, so we probably would not know of his poetry had it not been for this little book, which his widow put together after his death. Catherine collected some 160 different pieces of sermons, much of which she had pieced together from notes taken by members of the congregation, because Babcock never wrote out his sermons. He just made sketchy notes. Some of his prayers and some of his poetry are in here. No one had ever seen the poetry before because he strictly wrote it for his own amusement. But after this little book was published, there were 19 of his poems. At least 9 of them have been set to music and sung of hymns. And, of course, the one we all know today is "This Is My Father's World." I don't think time is going to allow us to sing it this morning, but I wanted to show you a few of the verses that didn't make it into the hymnal. This one would seem to be inspired by God's remark to Job, and it would really be meaningful to us, thinking as we might about cosmology and the great lights that began shining in the sky. This one sounds like Elijah's experience after fleeing into the mountains, but I think geologists could relate to the plate tectonics that are alluded to here. And finally, this was the original concluding stanza. There were 16 verses in all, and this would be both a very fitting one to sing and also a very fitting conclusion to this talk. "This is my Father's world. Should my heart be ever sad, the Lord is King. Let the heavens ring. God reigns. Let the earth be glad." Thank you very much.